Тайван Сарнай. Just look at all you beautiful people. I like your smiles. Are they fake ones or real ones? That is the question. So how are you holding up with the sixth precept? We collected a few along the way back to Rajagiriya last Sunday. You didn't get that, did you? So on the way back to Rajagiriya Main Street, we collected a few along the way. You still didn't get that, did you? So some had thrown a few out the window. Was it easy to keep or difficult to keep? The sixth precept? Only those who were here last week might know about this. Unless, of course, you listen to the sermon online. Was it tough? When life's adversities come your way? And life becomes challenging. People, that's the problem, isn't it? People. Usually it's people. It's them, isn't it? It's always them. You know what they say? What do they say? They say it's you. But I don't believe them. I believe you. It's them. So when people start acting up, people start doing things and saying things, and then you have to keep true to your word. To observe the sixth precept and to keep true to it simply means you don't take the default path that everyone else does. Now you know the drill, right? When there's ignorance, there's attachment. When there's attachment, there's a wanting, along with that vexation. And when there's vexation, now you need to relieve yourself of vexation. That is the default path. That's what everyone does. So when it starts getting heated up inside, what do people do? Just like what the pressure cooker does. When it starts getting heated up inside, what does the pressure cooker do? With a loud noise? You heard that? Do you have a pressure cooker at home? Do you? What do you call him? Sorry, it. Is it an it? Or is it a he? Or is it a she? I don't know. You tell me. We don't have pressure cookers at the monastery. We left them behind. They're no good. So that is the default route. When the pressure starts building up inside, it has to be released because people don't know any other way. They don't know an alternative. So then what they do is they relieve that pressure. They just look for a vent and then they relieve it. And if you're standing in front of it, then you get the brunt of it. That's what happens. That's why I always say there are no such things called bad people. Badness gets people. People are victims of badness. That's all it is. We need to be wise to understand that. And then what happens is inside of you begins to brew compassion. That's what happens. When you can treat someone the way you'd like to be treated, and when you realize, you know, like when you get hot-tempered, you want someone to understand you, don't you? Just take yourself back to an incident that might have happened long, 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 long time ago. They don't happen to you nowadays, do they? Hot temper? No. No, Swami, no answer. They don't happen to us now. We are good. Hmm? What's your record now? How many days? How many days of abstinence? From talking back, firing back, shouting back, fighting back, retaliation. How many days of abstinence now? You keep count. That's a nice target to have. Just keep count. You know, in your little notebook you might have, maybe, one at home. Your virtue book or something, merit book, if you keep something like that. Just keep track of how many days and counting you've abstained yourself from firing back. It's difficult, it's not easy, but it's impossible for those who don't understand the Dhamma. Therefore, it's not impossible for you. If you don't give someone the Dhamma, there's no point in telling them, don't be angry, because that is an impossibility. Don't be angry makes no sense, because no one wants to be angry. No one wants to be angry. So they don't just become angry because they want to. People don't like being angry. When you're angry, do you enjoy being angry? Isn't that why you go and say, tell other people, you know, stop making me angry. Stop doing these things that make me angry. So why do you ask others to stop doing things that make you angry? Because you don't like to be angry. Others, what would you say? Come on, do something to make me angry, will you? You don't hear yourself saying that. No one likes to be angry. Because anger hurts you more than it hurts the other person. Always. Always, 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 always. You are punished by your anger. Anger is a punishment. Don't you think so? The last time you got angry, who was the first to be punished? Because, you know, on times when if you are aware of your where you are and the people around you, and if you really care about them, sometimes you try to control yourself, right? So when you control yourself, that is good, because you just don't vent it out and others don't get attacked for it. But still inside, it's brewing. Now you are punished and you can't even let it out. At the workplace, if you're angry with your boss, now what do you do? That's a real dilemma. You really want to get it out, but if you get it out, then you're going to get out. Yeah? So, that's a real dilemma. And that's when the pressure really starts building up. Because so many things that you want to get off your chest, but it's just not the right place and you can't do it. So what happens? Then you get home. And then, the poor dog. Who else? The poor wife and the poor children, yeah, they all get it. And the furniture? How did that door handle come off? You know how those doors get shut when you have a temper inside, right? They go with a bang. That's your big bang. So you also have a Big Bang Theory. That's why if people don't understand the Dhamma, I'd never tell them not to be angry. I won't. Because I know that anger is not something they do volitionally. It's not intentionally done. It just happens. What about desire? Do you intentionally desire? Do you lust intentionally? No, you don't do that intentionally. Lust is a fire. I mean, who lights themselves up? No one does that. People are vulnerable. They're susceptible to the pangs of desire, aversion, and delusion. Only because of their lack of understanding of the Dhamma, that's all. That's why here you get the medicine for that. Once you're healed, you need not worry about anger. Right now you may be worried about anger. You may be worried about what you might do, what you might say, and then you later on regret. Maybe as a father, maybe as a mother, maybe as an employee or even an employer. Perhaps you're worried, maybe you're concerned. Maybe you've been given a warning at work Mister, learn to control your temper, right? This is your first warning. Second time, third time, you're out. Now you're worried. Maybe you received a formal written warning. Control your temper. And now you're worried because you know that you don't want to be angry, but when anger strikes, who do you run to? That's why what we do here is put in place a philosophy. We give you a philosophy, and once you understand that, you don't have to be worried about getting angry because you won't. This is treating the problem before it happens. Anger management is trying to handle the problem after it has happened. It's like disaster management. You're familiar with disaster management, right? When there are landslides, when there are tsunamis, when there are earthquakes, there are disaster management teams. They manage once the disaster has happened. That's no good in the Sambuddha Sasana. That's not good enough. That's not what we subscribe to. We don't do disaster management, we do disaster avoidance. Beat that. We do what? Disaster avoidance. We can avoid disaster. You don't have to manage disaster after that. No, bro, no heart breaks. No furniture breaks. No glass breaks. None of that sort. No relationship breakdowns. No. No divorces. No. This is disaster avoidance. So that is what the sixth precept is about. I would not precept you with the sixth precept if I had not given you the Dhamma, if I had not been giving you the Dhamma for the last however many weeks. We did the 50th sermon only a few weeks ago. Which one is this now? 60? No? 58? 58? Something like that. So 50 weeks on, and I feel now you have something to manage yourself with. Now you have some understanding of the Dhamma such that you have now applied the Dhamma to an extent where even if anger arises in your mind, even if you're hurt because of what someone else has done or someone else has said, even if you're hurt, you realize it's only hurt people that hurt people. You realize that hurt is something you make within you. It's not something that someone gives to you. So once you realize where hurt's coming from, where it's born, now you can go there and quell it once and for all. But if you believe that hurt comes from the outside, then of course you try to deal with it where you think it arises. Most people point their finger out and say, "Don't make me angry." Don't they? Because where do they think anger comes from? Others. Therefore, they're forever miserable. Where does loneliness come from? Still, people think others make them feel lonely. "Please don't leave me." Haven't you heard people say, "Please don't leave me. I'll be lonely." So where does loneliness come from? The actions of others, apparently. "Don't do that, it makes me angry." See, people think other people's actions make them angry. We are about trying to turn people 180 degrees in the other direction. This is completely turning it on its head and helping people realize, no, anger does not come from the outside. The Dhamma is to empower you. If nothing else, the Dhamma is to empower you. It's to help you understand, folks, that you are in complete control of every sentiment, every emotion that goes through your heart. You are in complete control. Wouldn't you like that? Wouldn't you like to have the power to be who you want to be? I don't mean your ambitions per se. I mean, if you don't want to be angry, you don't have to be angry. But right now you can't say that. Nobody wants to be angry, but people get angry. Nobody wants to be jealous, Because it hurts within you when you're jealous, but people do. They become jealous. When lust strikes you, you know you're helpless. And then you have to control yourself. Then you go, where are the chains? Tie me up, please. I'm feeling lustful. I don't know what I might do. See? That's a shame. It doesn't have to be that way. Ignorance takes power away from you. Wisdom gives power back to you. Power to the people. That's what the Buddha Dhamma does. It gives you back your power, the power that you deserve. The right to choose how you want to feel. The right to be in total control of your emotions. If you want to be happy for the rest of your life, you can be. If you want to be joyful for the rest of your life, I tell you folks, you can be. You can. It's completely in your control. No one can take it from you. Because it was never anyone's to give to you. Once you realize that, now you're a free man. That is total independence. Make me angry if you can. I dare you. But if you do, I was not always like this though. I've had my bad times. That's why I speak with conviction. I'm experiencing the results of going through the Dhamma and this journey and the transformation that has happened within me internally. That's why I speak with such conviction. This is not just hearsay. I'm not relating to you something someone has told me. This is not narrating someone else's story. This is my autobiography. It's my story. I'm here to share with you. That's why I don't have to consult. That's why I don't have to ask before I tell you what happened to me. I don't have to ask anyone to tell you what happened to me. I know what happened to me. I'm a man who needed a woman to be by my side. Today I don't feel alone. I don't feel like someone has to be by my side to cheer me up, to keep me happy. See? I have regained my power. What ignorance did to me was drain me of my power and made me feel helpless. It took me down on my knees just as much as it does many other people around the world. It brings people down to their knees. Have you not seen people on one knee in front of another saying what? Please make me happy. Why do people go begging for happiness? It's not something you have to beg for. It's your right. It's your right. The Dhamma is your right. The Buddha's Dhamma is your right. As a human being, it is your right. So claim your right. Claim it. That's what you have come here for. Claim it. Claim it and then proclaim it as I'm doing today. Share it with the other people. Tell them what you have gained. Tell them how you have won. Tell them how you've gone from victim to victor. Tell them. Convince them that this is possible. Tell your friends. But once it has happened for you, not before. If you just walk down and say, I don't get angry anymore, and then they try and tease you, and then they call you shorty, and they call you baldy, and they call you fatso, and if you get worked up, you get angry, and then you're just lying. You still get angry. If remarks about how you look still annoy you, that's because you still feel that this is me. You identify yourself by your looks. You believe that you, how tall your body is how tall you are. That's ignorance. We are fighting for freedom, yes, but in a very different way. From the dawn of history, man has fought for freedom, haven't they? Man has fought for freedom. Freedom for the blacks, freedom for the whites, freedom for women, freedom for children, freedom for the poor, freedom for the rich. Freedom. People are always fighting for freedom. Freedom for the lesbians, freedom for the gays, freedom for the bisexuals, freedom for the homosexuals, freedom for the heterosexuals. People are always fighting for freedom. Why don't people realize that what they need is freedom from themselves? But how can they? Not until you listen to the Dhamma. Then you realize you have put yourself in a prison and then locked it from inside. And then you say, free me. That's why I said, this is power to the people. No one can entrap you. No one. You believe, if you feel that you are a victim, it is because you are a victim of yourself. That's why. That's why the sixth precept is to remind you that you are responsible for your own happiness. Just as much as you are responsible for your own suffering. Once you take complete responsibility of that, ladies and gentlemen, now we can talk. Until then, this is just music to deaf ears. Until then, this is just Picasso to the blind. So that is why I want you to fasten your seatbelts. That is what the sixth precept is all about. Fastening your seatbelts. From here on, no more retaliation. No more raising my voice up when I'm annoyed. Because I'm here to realize that annoyance is something that happens within me. I create it and I suffer. Of course, if you create it, who else has to suffer? Next door neighbor? If you create it, you suffer. If you cook it, you eat it. Right? Yeah. But like I say, I would not have given you that precept if I had not armed you with the Dhamma initially. That's why in 50 weeks of making, that's what happened. So if you only came along last week for the first time, then I'm sorry. If last week was your first visit and that was the first time you listened to a talk, and now Swami Nuance says no fighting back, no shouting back, no screaming back, no tit for tat, no retaliation, that would have been a bit unfair. It would have. Because having not given you a way to not be angry, I'm asking you not to be angry. That makes no sense. But if you've been listening to the talks, if you've been coming along, if you've been practicing, if you've been doing your merits, then by this point, it is becoming possible for you. You are the testimony for that. You know, anything I share with you, ladies and gentlemen, soon enough, if you do as I say, then soon enough, you will become the testimony to all of these things. I don't want any of you to take my word for anything I say. Try it out. You have a lab just as much as I do. Where is it? Where's your lab? What is that lab called? Life. Your lab is the lab of life. So don't take my word for anything I say. When I tell you that you can be free from anger, not so that you have to manage your anger, but you can avoid anger, don't take my word for it. Try what I share with you. Try it for a few weeks. Try it for a couple of months. And then come back and tell me whether it has happened for you or not. When I promise you that you can look at that piece of cheesecake in the fridge and turn away without digging yourself into it, without snatching a bite of it, When I tell you that you can do it, try out what I teach you for a few weeks, for a couple of months, and then check for yourself. Don't just take my word for it. Because I share with you things that are doable for all human beings. All you need is a little bit of intelligence, which you have plenty of. All you need is some merits, which you keep doing week on week on week. All you need is a little bit of willpower, a little bit of willpower, initially. Later on, you won't need willpower. Trust me. It is not my willpower that keeps me from being angry. It's not like when you come and say something, if you came up to me and said something, intentionally even to annoy me, it's not like, I have to pretend to be happy now. Let me try and do that. Otherwise, they might think that I'm lying. Hello, sir. No. I don't have to pretend not to be angry. Patience is for patience. You got that? Patience is for patience. If you have to be patient, that's because you are a patient. An arahatun vahanse is not patient. He doesn't need to be. They say patience is a virtue, meaning it's something you have to practice. But once you have attained wisdom, you no longer need patience. Patience is when you're trying to act against your nature. That's when you need patience. Patience is a virtue, of course, when you live in society. If you don't have the Dhamma, then you need patience. Of course you do. But don't resort to patience for the rest of your life. It is nothing to be proud of. To put up your hand and say, you know, when people try to annoy me, I remain patient. As a Buddha Sravaka, it's not something that you can be proud of, I tell you. As a good citizen, yes. Yes, as a good citizen, yes. It's a good virtue. Yes, I agree. But as a Buddha Sravaka, no. It's nothing to be proud of. It's nothing to write home about. A true Buddha Sravaka need not be patient. Because if there's no pressure building up inside, then why do you have to be patient? All of this is possible, all of this is doable. Hang in there and do as I say. You will win. You will come out victorious. How do I know? A little bird told me so. How do I know? I read it on Wikipedia. No, that's not how I know. If that was so, I would not come up here and talk to you. I'd put Wikipedia on the board and say, read it. I share with you this because it has happened for me. Like I say, I was not born this way. I was born with the same defilements like every human being. Wanting things, yearning things, longing for things, needing things, crying, weeping, grieving, jealous. All of that. I came with the full package. There was nothing lacking about me. My parents were so proud. I was not handicapped in any way. But I was not proud of that. Today I'm handicapped in many ways. If you get what I mean. Because my teacher had his way with me. He held me by my neck. And he found my nerve, the nerve that got me angry, and he cut it out. And now it's in the trash. Apparently someone else picked it up. Then there was a nerve that wanted me, that got me lusting. So he got a pair of scissors and then he cut that and he threw it away. So now I'm handicapped in that way. So don't come asking me. So my hand in marriage, I'm handicapped. I can't make you happy that way anymore. Sorry. No, he thinks I will walk and ask him, what does he think he is? Just saying. I know, beautiful people like you, you don't need people like me. I'm just saying, right? All I'm saying is, folks, independence is just within reach. It's just out there. Just there. Just reach out, grab it, it's yours. It's only a sermon away. That's how far independence is. One sermon away. Perhaps today you're going to hear that. Maybe. I don't come with an agenda. Just start speaking and see what comes out of my mouth. Sometimes I'm surprised by the things I say. You know that, right? Where did that come from? That's because it's not me who create this stuff. This is the work of God. It's not me who create this stuff. This is vipaka. When the right conditions align, and there are causes which are our combined merits, right? And we create this environment where good, wholesome, good, kind-hearted people get together in the hope of freeing themselves from the clutches of raga, desha and moha, magic begins to happen. That's not my doing. If you don't do any merits and you just come here and sit down like a couch of, I don't know, bag of potatoes, nothing's going to happen. I'd be sitting here scratching my head wondering what are we going to talk about today. Okay, let's talk about Jack and the Beanstalk. The only reason the Dhamma flows is because there are the right causes and the conditions. I don't take credit for any single one of these things that we hear today. It would be foolish of me to say that this is my doing. Because then I'd be the biggest hypocrite here. I'm preaching one thing, but I believe in something else. The core of what we talk about is no one can take credit and no one can take blame. Because there's no one to take either of them. Yes? That's why I always remind you, folks, there's no room for regret in the Sambuddha Sasana. Because there's no one to regret. We learn lessons, of course. You know, we're not just blind to our history. We learn lessons from our history. But we don't regret history because history is not ours. And in the same way, we don't take credit for what I did yesterday. I don't take credit for what I did yesterday because that was not me who did it. Makes no sense. If I'm to take credit for what I did yesterday, then I should be taking credit for what you do today. Because those are all individual chittas. There's no self here to take any credit or take any blame. That's the truth. Are these words making sense to you? Because it won't make sense to everyone. That much I know. If it's making sense to you, it's because you have the merits to understand what I mean. Sometimes you have to read between the lines. That's why your wisdom is your gift. It's not mine. What you understand from what I say is your own making. That's your gift. So give yourselves a pat on the back. When you free yourself from suffering, give yourselves a pat on the back. It's not my doing. I don't take credit for it. If there's anyone you want to give credit for, it is the Buddha. Buddha is truth. Buddha is wisdom. That is what Buddha is. Through this course, a Buddha will be born in each and every one of you. This project is about creating Buddhas within each and every one of you. And to do that, all we have to do is take the chisel and take the hammer and chisel away the bits about you that are not Buddha. That's all. What's left is the Buddha. You have the Buddha and then some. That's the problem. You try to be more than the Buddha. Come on, get a grip of yourself. Huh? Who do you think you are? That's the problem. You think you are someone. That is the problem. Stop trying to be someone. And then you are a Buddha. Because the Buddha is nature. Buddha is Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankara, and Vijnana. That's what Buddha is. Buddha is wisdom, Buddha is nature, Buddha is the truth. You are the truth and then some. That's the problem. There's the truth. You are the truth. And then you create something in addition to that. And now you are the truth and a bit of false. And a bit of a lie. It's that part we just need to take away. Just scrape it off. It's a sieve that we have to just take it off. And you're free. So, your aspiration is to witness the Buddha. Over there is a statue. I want you to witness the Buddha. Witness. Not just see. I want you to witness the Buddha. What do I mean by witness the Buddha? See him within you. In fact, he's not even a him. What gender is the Buddha? Okay, what gender is the truth? Is the truth male or female? So is the Buddha male or female? See, you need to understand in which context I mean this. Right? For the fool, they'll be thinking that I'm now insulting the Buddha. That's what the fools will say. See, he's now questioning the gender of the Buddha. There are those questioning where he was born, and now this stupid monk, he's even questioning his gender. One of these days, they're going to put me on a cross. But, you know, this is not for the fools. This is for the wise. The Buddha says himself, the Dhamma is only for the wise. It is not for the fools. Because the fools won't understand it. So, do you want to observe the sixth precept today as well? Sure. Okay, give me a virtual show of hands if you kept it over the last week. Virtual. Good. See, I can always be happy that way. Because in my mind, you're all putting your hands up. That's how I think. I think you've all been very good at it, right? And you've all kept your precept, and you've never, over the course of the last week, right, you didn't shout back at anyone, you didn't hit back, you didn't attack anyone for anything that was said or done, or unsaid or undone, whatever. And if ever you had to punish, we talked about punishing last week, parents have to punish their children from time to time, but that punishment has to be done out of compassion. You must not punish if you can't see what good that punishment will do to the child. You can't punish when you're angry. Oh, don't do that. Because then it's not the child you're punishing. Trust me. For your sake, trust me. When you're angry, don't punish your child. You should be able to punish your child the following day for what he's done today. Can you? You should be able to punish your child a week later for what he's done today. But that is virtually impossible if inside you are pressuring up, you're heating up, you're burning up inside. Now you just want to relieve yourself of that vexation, that anger. And so what do you do? You give him the cane treatment. But if you are sensible and you're not vexing up inside, then you should be able to call your child, Putta, now I'm going to punish you for what you did last week. Last week I didn't punish you because I was angry. But now I'm not. You did something last week. This is why you should have done. This is what you did. So I'm going to punish you now. Please don't do that again. Understood? You should be able to do so. So, you ready for another week of the sixth precept? Yes? Fabulous. Right. Let's take a moment then to bring our palms together. in veneration of the great master who is the father of freedom, who has shown us a path, who is our light, our beacon of hope and our beacon of light to cross the path of samsara and to attain the ultimate bliss of nibbana.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa.
How does your understanding of the Dhamma actually help you be like that? Metta sahagatena chetasa viharana. Let's try and make sense of that. You know what metta is? Your understanding is loving kindness. There are many words for it. Actually, metta is something that transcends the word itself. I sometimes wonder how the Buddha came up with these words. Because, I don't know, for me, it doesn't quite encapsulate these meanings. I mean, what is Nibbana? Nibbana is not Nibbana, that's the thing. How can you capture something that is beyond this world into a word that is worldly? It makes no sense. Is mother's love love? How much does your mother love you? She loves me. Does that actually do justice? When I ask you the question, does your mother love you? You say yes. Do you feel that you have completely conveyed the love that she has for you in just that one word? Yes. Does she love you? Yes. It doesn't do justice, does it? Because we're trying to use a word to convey something that cannot be quantified. But when, as soon as we start putting syllables and letters and words and sentences, we are always quantifying things because we want some way to identify something. Just the same as you call yourselves me. You're trying to quantify something that is infinite. Once you realize that, you will stop calling yourself that. Right now you think that you are a package. 60 kilos, this, you know, 5'6", you think that's you. What you don't realize is this is just energy. Because in this world we live in, everything has a quantity. As they say, money can buy. Well, I don't know. I think some people say most things, others say anything. Yeah. Because, you know, in the world that we live in a world of zeros and ones. So, everything has a value. Everything can be quantified, or at least people think everything can be quantified. And so, everything's put on a scale. People measure themselves against each other. All because people think that they can be compared. They can be quantified and then compared. But the truth is, you can't compare things like that. How do you compare? You know, tell me which one's better, the sun or the moon? Live one day without the moon and then you'll see. Live one day without the sun and then you'll see. Which one's better then? Which one would you pay more for, the sun or the moon? See? You can't answer that question. Just having the sun itself won't do. Yes, scientists will say that it is the moon that reflects the sun's light and that's how you see the moon. I'm not talking about seeing the moon. I'm talking about the moon's presence. Without the moon's presence, you won't have the oceans and the way that the waters work in that way. You don't have the tide. You don't have plenty of things without the moon. The seasons would change. The world we know it would not be the same without the moon. But what about the sun? Well, the world we know it wouldn't be the same without the sun. So which one would you pay more for? But people, in their minds, human beings, they tend to quantify things. And that's wrong. People tend to quantify things, ladies and gentlemen, because people see things as units. That's why. They see things as entities. The moment you start to see the world as entities, now they have dimensions. Don't you have dimensions? This board, it has dimensions. The physical world that we know, it has dimensions. Do you know who created the physical world? A mind that thinks in dimensions created the physical world. Did you know that there's a world called the Arupa Vichara world? The formless world. In that world, there are no dimensions. Why? Because once the mind realizes that these dimensions are pointless, they're worthless. Form need not take dimensions. Now the mind does not create such a world. The demon always creates its abode. That's the way it works. Translate that to Sinhala, it will sound more familiar to you. The Yaka and his Vimani. Yeah, the devil always creates its abode. Before we go somewhere, we create that environment for us. The same concept applies to heaven and hell as well. You create your heaven before you go there. You create your hell before you go there. So we live in a world of dimensions because our minds think in dimensions, because our minds always need something to grasp. That's why you were born with 10 fingers. So you can grasp. Anguli. That's why once you come to the sasana, you do Anjali. Anjali Karani. Yes. Is one of the virtues. What about Anguli? That's how you create the world. This is to fight. Anguli. You've heard of Anguli Mala. Anjali. When you let go. That's why in our culture we greet like this. Ayubovan. Not like this. Not like this. We don't grasp. We let go. That is our culture. Our culture is heavily influenced by the Noble Triple Gem. See, no clenching. Letting go is what we have come for. You don't do this. Now stop. Don't stop doing this. You do that, right? When you're out there, you do that. But you don't do that with the Swami Nuhansi, do you? What do? You do this. In our tradition, in our culture, we do that. When you greet your teachers, you do that. Because once you are in front of your teacher, this is a mark of why you are there in front of your teacher. Why you have come to see your teacher. I want to do this. Do what? Let go. Not grasp. Not cling. Let go. You are born with these 10 because it represents the 10 unmeritorious deeds. Panatipata. Adinnadana. Kamesumichacha. Musavada. Pisunavacha. Parushavacha. Samprappalapa. Abhidhya, Vyapada, Mithya Dushti. In your mind, you create your abode before you settle. But now, once you have an understanding of the Dhamma, you let go. Once again, I'll say this, not everyone will agree with me, and that's okay. Most will think that I'm just cooking up some funny story. If this doesn't make sense to you, if you are not happy to accept this, what should you do? Come and fight me. Let's have a debate, shall we? You know, you don't need to debate with me because you're always right and I'm always wrong. So you don't need to debate with me. If ever you feel like you have to come and debate with me, you are always right and I'm always wrong. Now there's no reason to debate. But I'm sharing with you what I understand. Paticchasamuppada is the philosophy through which you can explain everything in this world. The principle of cause and effect. So there has, if this is an effect, there must be a cause for that. Why are we not born with 11 digits? There must be a cause for it. Every strand of hair on your head can be explained through the Paticchasamuppada process. Every strand of hair, every cell in your body is a creation that is a result of causes. I don't have the wisdom to explain all that, but if you asked a Buddha, he would tell you why a single strand of your hair, part of it is grey, the other half is black, and the other half is coloured. And at the end of it, it's split. He'll tell you why. That is because he is Loka Vidu. He has nothing can be kept secret from him. He understands the whole world, he understands the universe, he understands the cosmos, he understands everything. If he wants to know, he can know. That's also not a magic either. Those days I also think that was some kind of supernatural power. How is that possible? But now I understand why that can be possible. You see, in this world, folks, the way things work are, things always work in a complementary way. In other words, it's like every lock has a key and every key has a lock. So they work in complementary pairs. In other words, the truth is there in the universe. Right? The truth is always there. When you can tune your mind to the truth, now you become aware of it. The Buddha represents full awareness. Now you see, what we are trying to do here by expounding the Dhamma, I'm teaching you the Dhamma, you're learning the Dhamma. What I'm trying to do is to elevate your level of thinking, your intellectual capacity. I'm trying to lift you up from where you are to the level I want you to be. And we are doing this through a series of talks, and along that you're doing merits and all that. Step by step, you're lifting yourselves up. So you see, the way you understand the Dhamma today may not be how you understood the Dhamma on the first week. In the first week you came along and you understood something. The second week you understood a little bit more of something. By the third week you thought you were completely confused. And then came the fourth week and you thought, nah, forget it, I'm just going to give up. But then for the fifth week they started giving free sandwiches, so you thought, I'll come anyway. Right? So you carried on. And then today, you're glad that you carried on. Can you remember the person who came here on the first week? Do you remember them? Is it the same person that you are now? You are a different animal altogether, aren't you? Transformed beyond recognition. If the two of you were kept side by side, you'd say, that's not me. Oh no, that's not me. Please take them away. Don't insult me. Just as much as I feel about my journey. So what we're doing is we are creating an environment within your mind so that it's like an antenna. Once we tune you, you then become aware, you then become receptive to the truth that exists in the universe. I am not inventing these truths for you. All I'm showing you is how you can acquire the same wisdom that anyone can simply by tuning your mind to it. That's what we're doing. This is more like mental calibration, more than anything else. Tuning it. That's why we do merits. So the Buddha, because his mind was pure, perfect, now that mind is receptive to all truths in this world. So to whatever degree we can tune our minds, to whatever degree we can cleanse our minds of ignorance, to that degree you can be aware of the truth of this universe. That's all. He is special, I give you that, That's why he's the supremely enlightened one. That's why he's the fully awakened one. That takes a lot of time and effort to achieve to that state. But the thing is, anyone can. You know, if any of you wanted to become a supreme Buddha, it's within your reach. It's not an impossible feat. It'll take you a mighty long time, but it's possible. It's possible. It was one of the things that appealed to me initially as a Buddhist. The fact that I was of a religion where the leader of the religion says that I can become like him if I wanted to. That appealed to me initially. Now I know that I can and how I have to. I don't want to. But it appealed to me initially. That it was not forbidden territory. That I could question, how does one become the Buddha? And to those questions, that they were not forbidden questions. They were not questions to which no answers were offered. That appealed to me. But I'm not saying that is the making of a good Buddhist. The making of a good Buddhist is not someone who understands those things necessarily. It's someone who understands who they are. That's the making of a good Buddhist. But what we need to understand is coming back to the basics, coming back to the truth. The truth is available to all of us. We just need to elevate ourselves one step at a time, lift ourselves up one step at a time, do the little things that we have to do every day, but consistently, and that will take us to where we want to be. So we were talking about, what were we talking about? Now I lost my train of thought. I like it when people take notes, then I can ask them what we were talking about. What were we talking about, Meta? Tune in the mind, and before that? Anyone remember what we were talking about? We talked about sandwiches, and then? Yes, and when before that? How did I get here? Metta, yes, thank you. Thank you, Metta. So I was trying to get to the point of how we can get to that point where we can be compassionate. That's where we started. I said loving kindness does not actually capture the essence of what Metta is. And then I started to say, I don't know how the Buddha comes up with these words. So I better not continue because I'll get lost again. Right. So metta. Metta sahagatena chetasa viharanam samadhiyami. That is the precept that you took on. To understand how to be full of metta, let's actually turn the question on its head and ask ourselves why people are not of metta. So let's take the opposite of that. Let's flip it around. Why does metta not work within us? Why don't we always have metta? In which moments, in which instances do we not have metta the way that we want to? Why is it that we have to take this precept? Because a precept is a training rule, essentially. So we are training ourselves to be always full of metta towards all sentient beings. That is the training that we are doing. Why are we not always full of metta then? To be full of metta, we call it loving kindness, compassion, whatever. Let's just call it metta, because that's the word the Buddha chose. Sorry. To be full of metta, to have a heart of metta, for that to be your temperament. You need to understand a few truths about this world. There are two types of metta. One is worldly. It's also called laukika. That is a Sinhalese term. Laukika. Meaning worldly metta. Then there is noble metta. Arya. So you can call it supramundane. You can call it lokottara. Or Arya is fine. There are two types of metta. This is very much practiced all over the world. Mothers have it towards their children, and children towards their parents. Friends have it amongst themselves. It's a sense of willingness to help, look after each other, to be there for the other person. Right? It's about being nice and being gentle and being kind. Are they bad things? No, that is where we must start. If you can't be this, it's virtually impossible to get to that. Because this earns you merits. Can you all see the board? Is it up there? Okay. Worldly metta earns you merits. Noble metta earns you nibbana. Merits help you come across a teaching that teaches you what noble metta is, that gets you to nibbana. Now you see the path. Make sense? Because you need merits to come across the teaching that teaches you what noble metta is, and then you practice noble metta, and that takes you to nibbana. You can't do just worldly metta and get to nibbana. There is no, this path does not exist. This wavy line, there's no direct path. So there's an indirect connection between worldly metta and nibbana. Yes, there is. So if you don't understand what noble metta is for the time being, what do you have to do? Give up? What do you have to do? Just carry on doing worldly metta. So this is within the grasp of almost everyone. Every good man, every good woman, every good person practices worldly metta. Like I said, it's when you're nice to someone. If you see an old man and you want to help that person cross the street, when you volunteer to do that, that is worldly metta. There are plenty of causes that you fight for, right? Say, reforestation. You care about the world. What kind of metta do you think that is? Is that not metta? That is loving kindness. Yes, but worldly. Is it bad? Should we stop it? No. We do that. You want to save wildlife. Save wildlife. Wildlife conservation. Save the oceans. Save nature. Save the environment. Say you build an old people's home. You contribute towards an orphanage. You make a monthly donation to an orphanage. What is that? Worldly metta. Bad? Oh no. Good. That helps you pump fuel. So that one day you get to a teaching that will help you discover what noble metta is, which then siphons you, rockets you into nibbana. As the Buddha says, Ma bhikkave punyanam bahaitta, sukassetang adivachanang punyanti. The Buddha says, monks, do not fear merits. As some might say, you may hear in some circles, some schools of thought, they talk about this. Don't do merits because it takes you in samsara. If you go to that sermon, please don't come to this sermon. I mean, pick one or the other. Because here you'll be hearing all sorts of things completely against that. The Buddha says, in his own words, Do not fear merits. This is the advice he gives to monks. Now, what about the lay community then? If he says, Ma Bhikkhave, who is Bhikkhave? Monks. Ma Bhikkhave? Ma Bhikkhave is not my monks. Ma is to avoid. So don't be afraid is what Ma Bhikkhave Punyanang Bhaita is. Punyanang is merits, Bhaita is to be afraid, to be fearful. Don't be afraid of merits. Do as much merits as you can. Because merits is the path that gets you to comfort, to that which is good, to that which is wholesome, ultimately to Nibbana. Now you see the path. This is why being charitable, being generous, helping people are all good things that you can do to get to Nibbana. Because what you give is what you get, right? So when you do worldly meritorious deeds, you give. You give so that you can get this, the teaching. Noble metta is only something that you will understand once the Dhamma reaches your mind. You have to have the Dhamma to get to noble metta. Because, folks, you need the Dhamma to elevate you from a worldly understanding to a supramundane understanding. Only the Dhamma can do that. Because for you to get noble metta, you need noble companionship. You need noble companionship. You have to associate an Aryan Mahansa. And once you have the merits to associate a noble companion, now the noble companion teaches you what nobility is. What nobleness is. And that is by expounding the Dhamma. And once you understand that, then you get to Nibbana. So whatever you do today in terms of worldly merits, worldly metta, please continue doing that. If you support your local charity, do it. Helps you earn merits. If you support your local church, do it. If you are the patron of your local mosque, do it. Don't stop that. But that is all worldly. Doing these merits will pave a path for you to one day do something for something that is more than worldly. That's something that steps you into nobleness. And when that opportunity arises, then do for that as well. So this is the path that gets you to Nibbana. Now that you understand that there are two forms of metta, right from a very young age, when we were, if you remember time from Dhammapasa, when you were younger, or even at school, do you remember you used to do metta bhavana? I would have gone something like this. May I and all beings in all worlds be happy, be well, free from suffering, and so on. Right? This is worldly. This is worldly because when you contemplate along those lines, along those words, along that, let's call it a bhavana karmasthana, if you will, when you contemplate along those lines, you're talking about I and all beings. That's to whom you spread your compassion. To I and all beings. Where there's an I, there's always a self. And when there are all beings, well, your sense of self is what separates I from the rest of the world. So when you are the I, all beings are the rest of them. So now you have divided the world into two parts, me and everyone else. What is the crux of Buddhism? That there is no such separation in this world. It is jati that happens in the mind. Jati is the product of the Parichasamuppada process that works in the mind that creates this separation in the world, when ultimately there is no such separation. This is how we perceive the world because of our ignorance. That's why right now, folks, you think you are an individual and the person sat next to you is another individual. That's why when one hand hits the other, you don't say, "Oh, sorry." But if you bump into someone else, you apologize. Should you not? Of course you should. But they expect that. If someone bumps into you, you expect them to apologize because someone else has bumped into you. But if you say you're eating something and you accidentally bite your tongue, now what do you do? "Oh, I'm really sorry. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. Do you keep apologizing to yourself? Why not? Because who did that to whom? I did that to myself, so therefore no apology required. But if someone bumps into you, now an apology is required. What does that tell you about yourself? That this is all me, and that is another person. So when another person bumps into me, they have to apologize. Whereas if I do something to myself, no apology needed. Ignorance wholesale. Honestly. Because in both instances, you just had energy. Now, I'm not for one moment suggesting that you must not be polite and courteous in society. Of course, we have to apologize. We have to have our T's and our Q's and all that. And that's all good. Right? We must be like that. But what I'm saying is our sense of expectation that others must apologize to us. You mustn't have that. I always want you to think in these terms, folks. Live to love, but don't love to live. What does that mean to you? You live to love. Meaning you live so that you can show love and compassion and kindness and generosity and charity and benevolence to everyone around you. But don't love to live. If you love to live, then you are someone who expects the same from everyone else. Because that is what living is. Expecting that from others, expecting others to be courteous towards you, expecting others to be polite towards you, expecting others to say sorry and thank you and all that to you. Because what happens when you have those expectations? You are setting yourself a trap. You're just walking into it. So as Rahatan Mohan says, as practitioners of Buddhist philosophy, Buddhist teaching, we must all live to love. We live to love, but we don't love to live. Do you see the distinction? That's where the Dhamma must take you. To a state of mind where you only live to love. But right now, what are you? Right now, what do you do? What are you? You love to live, right? Yes. Right now, you love to live. It is because you love to live, you can't do metta. That's why you can't do metta. Because you love to live. Because when you have things that you like, when you have things that you desire, when you have things that you want, in other words, when you love to live, why do people love to live? Ask someone who says, "I love, you know, life is so good, I love my life. What are they really saying? Here's what they're saying. "I like the way things are going. My life is just, you know, it's just taken a good turn. I love how things are going. I like what I see. I like what I hear. I like what I experience. I like the people that surround me." This is what they're saying. In other words, what they're saying is, life is treating me well. Life is good. In other words, what they're saying is the sights, the sounds, the smells, the taste and the touch that I get are all wonderful. Please keep giving them to me. May I and all beings in all worlds continue to be satisfied, to be pleased by the sights and the sounds and the smells and the taste and the touch that come to us from the outside world. In other words, they are still saying, what they're still thinking is that happiness comes to them from the outside world. That is when they love to live. Because to live is to see. Is it not? What do you do as you live? Were you alive yesterday? Is that a difficult question? Were you alive yesterday? How do you know? Because you saw. Yes, you saw. Saw what? Well, just about anything. As long as you saw something, you know that you were alive. How do you know you're alive right now? Because you can see. What else can you do that proves to you that you are alive? You can hear, so you know you're alive. You can smell, you can taste, you can touch, and you can think. These are the six senses that prove to you, that convince you, that remind you that you are still alive. Just imagine, if you couldn't see, smell, hear, taste, touch, or think, would you still say you're alive? Would you? No, what would you say? Well, you wouldn't say much, would you? You wouldn't be able to say much by that point. How does a doctor say that someone's dead? When they can't see, smell, taste, touch, hear, or think. So, the aggregation of those six things, more or less, right? Either all six of them, or at least five of them, four, three, two, one of them, at the very least, right? At least if you can think, the doctor might say that you're still alive. But generally these days, people, they check your senses, five of them, and if they're not working, they'll probably say, you're dead. Many a time, they pull the wire when the person is still alive. Because thinking still happens, but the five senses have stopped working, and what do? They pull the plug. Let's just hope you don't have to be in that situation any day. And particularly, if the decision has to be made about your own parents, please walk away. Please walk away. If the decision is to be made about your parents and the doctors come and ask you, well, she's not blinking, she hasn't been breathing, the machine's keeping her alive, and she's not responding to anything, I don't know, she looks dead to us, we're not sure, shall we pull the plug? If it's about your parents, just walk away. Then you'll ask me, so is it not my responsibility to answer that question? I'm the child, so I'm bound by duty. I have to answer that question because I'm the one who's paying the bills, perhaps. You know, these are the little traps that samsara gets you into. At that point, you are on the horns of a dilemma. I know. As the only child, perhaps you have to make that decision. But if you make the wrong decision, then you have just committed matricide, which takes away any hope of you attaining Nibbana for a very long time. I don't know, these are tough calls. I just hope and pray that you don't find yourself in such situations. Let the doctors decide in such instances. Doctor, you decide. I can't answer that. And the doctor says, well, it's not my job to decide, it's your job to decide. I'm just the one who keeps the cables plugged in. I don't know, toss a coin. Ask the doctor to toss a coin and do what it says. Just don't be the one who pulls the plug. Or who signs for that. Anyhow, coming back to something we can do something about, right? So, metta. Sabba sattesu metta sahagatena chetasa viharanam samadhiyami. To be able to practice this, you need to be able to look outside the bounds of worldly existence. For as long as you sense a self, and therefore you sense that you are an identity, you see the whole world as me and those who are not me. But the truth is, ladies and gentlemen, there is no such thing. These are only just manifestations. Your ignorance keeps telling you that you are an identity and everyone else is a self. Therefore, you don't see chittas. What you see are beings, sentient beings, all beings. All sentient beings. Now when it comes to Arimetta, that when you were at the monastery for the one-day retreat some time back, you had some time where our Swami Mahanses sat down with you and they chanted Arimetta and you followed. But in that script as well, you said the same thing, didn't you? May I and all beings in all worlds be freed from the fires of desire, freed from the fires of aversion, be freed from the fires of delusion and so on. So why do we use the same terms? Well, what terms are you suggesting to suggest we use then? Let's try writing down a script for noble metta. Okay, come on. May what? All? No, again, you have living beings. All living beings, meaning you've already you still quantified them. You're all living beings. But what we're saying is, your understanding of Dhamma, meaning when you are of noble understanding, your realization is that there are no such things called separate entities. Yeah? All there is manifestations that aggregate as energy. Now, how do you identify them? What name do you have for them? May what? Chittas. So, may? You can't say I. May all chittas. That works to some extent. That works to some extent. I say it works to some extent because as long as you understand that a chitta is also just a manifestation, it's okay. Because a chitta is also not something that is an entity. A chitta only survives for as long as the causes that sustain it survive. So a chitta itself is not a fixed entity. It's not just the sentient beings that are not fixed entities, ladies and gentlemen. Chittas themselves are also not entities because they are also natural phenomena, which are manifestations, which are instances of anicca. But it's okay to use the word chittas as long as you understand that when I say the word chitta, I simply mean an aggregation of energy. Well, now it goes back to the point. It goes back to the original karmasthana, all beings. Well, if chittas can be said with your understanding that they're only manifestations, why can't you say the same of all sentient beings? If when you say the word chittas in your karmasthana, in your contemplation, you can contemplate on the fact that a chitta is also merely a manifestation. Okay, so why can't you do the same with I and all sentient beings? So then conversely, you need not change the karmasthana in the first place. So the wording can be kept the same. Because just imagine, if we rewrote the script, may all chittas in all worlds. Now you have someone who doesn't understand what a chitta is. Now then you're going to have two sets of karmasthana, one for those who have understood the Dhamma and another for those who have not understood the Dhamma. That becomes ever so confusing. So therefore, what do? We just use the one script and then we chant it. Those who understand the Dhamma, they contemplate and realize that this is simply manifestations we are talking about. Those who don't, They think we're talking about actual living beings. Horses for courses. What I mean to say is, Nibbana is not in any of these things. It's not in the words that we use. It's in the way we interpret. It's in our comprehension. It's not in the words that we use. Any karmasthana that you listen to does not have Nibbana encapsulated within it. Etang santang etang panitang. Yadidang sabba sankara samato, sabbu padipati nissaggo, tanhakkeyo, virago, nirodo, nibbanati. That is a karmasthana. These are merely words. It's an attempt to encapsulate the essence of Nibbana, but it is not Nibbana. Like, how much does your mother love you? This much. Does that actually encapsulate how much your mother loves you? Does your mother love you? Yes. Does that actually convey the real love that she has for you? Yes. Yes. These are not things that can be quantified. We are talking about unquantifiable things here because they're not entities. Nibbana is not an entity. It is the only thing that is not an entity. Because Nibbana is the only thing that is not an entity, you can't use words to comprehensively capture what Nibbana is. It is simply something that the wise understand. What these sermons are meant to do is to help wisdom to arise within your minds. I can't give you wisdom. Wisdom is not something I can transplant. Wisdom is something that has to arise within you, but these words will create the environment for that. Please remember, and please understand, that none of these words actually has Nibbana within them. So just merely listening to this talk, you're not going to attain Nibbana. Because in these words, Nibbana does not exist. Now then tell me. Sorry, I don't mean to burst anyone's bubbles, right? But I have to tell you the truth. Some schools of thought believe that by chanting a certain sutra over and over and over and over and over again, you will ultimately attain Nibbana. I don't understand how that works. Who am I to say that it doesn't? But here's what I can say. I don't see how that works. If that is so, all you have to do is come every Sunday morning. I don't have to give you a sermon for you. I'll just sit down and go, Nibbana. Right? You just come here, sit down, listen to it. In fact, you don't even need to come. I'll send you the tape. And even when you go to sleep, just put it on. You know, like they have white noise. Or rain. People put these things when they go to sleep. And so you just put this chanting. Nibbana. Nibbana. Ting, 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 ting. Nibbana. You tell me how that works and I will stop these sermons and simply send you my recording of Nibbana. Just put it on repeat. I don't have to work so hard. We can save on petrol. We can save on the sandwiches. I don't know. We just keep coming back to those blooming sandwiches, right? I don't have to risk the journey coming all the way from Ingiriya. Huh? Just chant it. How a chanting can get one to Nibbana is just beyond me. Now, when you come to the monastery, there's a Buddha Mandira, right? In which there we do Buddhaguna chanting. Does that work then? Just chant itipi, so bhagava, arahang. Just keep chanting that and see whether you get to Nibbana. That's what we do at the monastery, right? Huh? No, that's not what we do at the monastery. You need to understand what you're chanting. Otherwise, it's just a chant. Otherwise, you know, you can get a parrot to attain Nibbana. If that works, right? Because what do parrots do? They just repeat whatever they hear. You can't do that. When you say arahang, you need to try and make sense of what that means. What does arahang mean? What does Bhagava mean? What does Samma Sambuddha mean? What does Vichacharana Sampanna mean? As you contemplate on those meanings, every time you hear a word that has meaning to you, it changes you, transforms you one little bit every time. It cleanses you. Arahang, 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 arahang. That's okay as long as you understand what arahang means. Otherwise, you can sing it in the finest tune that you know. Won't make the slightest difference. That is only my opinion. As I say, I don't mean to burst any bubbles or insult anyone, because there are some schools of thought that that's all they do. Some in the name of Buddhism, that's all they do. From morning to night, that's all they do. They wake up in the morning and then they chant. There are some people who, all due respect where it's deserved, such commitment they have. I mean, when you see the commitment that they have to that cause, it's just mind-boggling. I mean, it's astounding how they can be so committed to that cause. To that, you know, hats off. Such effort, such determination. That's priceless. But unfortunately, what they're doing, I can't see how that gets one to Nibbana. Just chanting. Then there are other places where you just have, say, bells. So there's a bell, and someone rings a bell. Ting. Ting. There are some people who all they do, they sit down, they close their eyes, they sit up in meditative pose and listen to that all day long, in the hope that that will settle the mind. It may settle the mind, yes, but it won't cleanse the mind. It's like if you took a glass of water, muddy water, and you set it to a side. After a while, what's going to happen? It's going to sediment. Right? The mud is going to go and settle on the bottom, and then the water will be at the top. Yes, that is settled, not cleansed. All you have to do is take a stick and stir it, and then the whole thing is back to what it was before. See how there are so many variations of what people believe Nibbana is, and therefore to get to the right path takes a bunch of merits. You have no idea how meritorious you must be to listen to these words. Because I'm not just giving you hearsay, I'm proving to you things. I'm telling you myself that Nibbana is not in Nibbana. It's not in the word Nibbana. It's not in the chime of a bell. Nibbana is wisdom within you. I can only give you a bunch of words that I hope, along with your merits, coupled with your merits, will give rise to wisdom within you, and you start to see the world through the lens of Dhamma. So, should we change the script of the noble metta? Should it be, may all chittas in all worlds be free from the fire of desire? Is that necessary? Is it necessary? It's not necessary for one who has understood the Dhamma. For one who has understood the Dhamma, it is sufficient to simply... That's enough. Just a reminder to do metta. What's that? It's just a blob. That's it. Nothing. In fact, you don't even need a chant. You don't need a script. Once you have understood the Dhamma, you don't need a script because you're always contemplating on the Dhamma. Once you have understood the Dhamma, you are your own karmasthana. Your understanding is your own karmasthana. That's why this is called the Dhamma teacher. The stream enterer is his own teacher. A sotapanna individual is his own teacher. His understanding becomes his teacher. That's why he needed the Buddha to initially plant that understanding in his mind, his or her. Once that understanding is in place, that understanding is their teacher. It's like a torch. Once the torch is on, now that is your guide. But while the torch is off, you're lost. You see, the path is always there, but you can't see. Therefore, you don't know which way to go. It's not like there is no path. The path is always there, but without the torch, you can't see. So which way are you going to go? Just imagine you are lost, or you're in a room, pitch black dark. Which way are you going to go? There are no windows, there are no doors to be seen, because it's all pitch, but there are doors and windows. Which way are you going to go? You don't know which way to go. In fact, you might even be stood on the path. If you walk straight and turn left, that's it, you're out. But you don't know which way to go because you don't have a torch, you don't have the light. And that is what the Buddha gives us. Chakkung Udapadi. Aloka Udapadi. Jnanang Udapadi. Vidya Udapadi. See? And once that happens, now you see the path. The path is always there. So the path to Nibbana is always there. It has always been there. It will always be there, ladies and gentlemen. You just need to open your eyes and see it. Your understanding of the Dhamma then will help you realize that it is because of jati that happens within your mind, which are just a bunch of chittas. It is because of jati that happens. These are the chittas that arise within you. It is in these chittas a sense of self is born, and because you have a sense of self, now you have an I and you have other sentient beings. Right? That separates you from the rest of the world. That's why even right now you believe that you are an individual and everyone else in this room is another individual. So therefore we can take a count. How many people in this room we can take a count? That's why you get married. You get married because you think you're getting married to another person. That's why someone who understands the Dhamma does not get married. What does that say about you? When's the wedding? If you have understood that I am not a separate entity, and therefore no one else is a separate entity, explain to me the concept of marriage. Come on, you're the experts, come on. I know the Dhamma, you know how the world works, right? Explain to me the concept of marriage. Once you understand that all there is matter and energy, right? And these are just manifestations, things have come together as compound aggregates, that's all. There is only a sense of self there is. There are no actual individuals out there. Now explain to me the concept of marriage. Who gets married to whom again? That's why I say, the Buddha saved me, folks. I was a married man. Hit me, someone, please. I was a married man. Because I thought I was an individual. And everyone else were also individuals. And then among those individuals, there were male individuals and female individuals. And then I looked at myself and I thought, oh, I'm a man. So I should get together with a woman. And then I found a woman individual. And then I realized I thought I should live together with her for the rest of my life. She was just as ignorant, which she kept on reminding me. She was just as ignorant, and therefore we tied the knot as man and wife. Where's the man? Where's the wife? if all there are just chittas which arise and pass away in bodies that are formed of the food that you stick in through your mouths, if that's all you are, then where is the man and the woman to get married? Think. Are you planning your daughter's wedding? Fathers, mothers, are you going to find a good boy for your daughter? Are you looking for a good girl for your son? Now, what do you think I think about gay people or lesbians? What do you think I think about them? Who again? Who? Gay? Lesbian? What's that? Straight? What's that? What is that? Who are men and women to begin with? Because the question of gender comes after. The question of preference comes after. But who is a man? Who is a woman? If all there is are chittas, and each chitta believes that I am an identity, and that identity, part of that identity is your gender, besides the physical being, but that physical being comes from eating the same stuff, just your DNA that reconfigures what you put in through your mouths into different shapes and different sizes and different compositions. If that's all your physical differences are, but you have this sense of, you know, it's your body never asked for another body of a different gender, did it? Does your body ever ask for that? Does your body ever ask for that? I mean, if you kept your hand like this, does your, all of a sudden you see your hand going like this to reach to a, you know, someone of another gender, the opposite gender? Like, you know, you're sat in the room right now. Like, if you are sat next to someone who is of the opposite gender, like, without your knowledge, do you feel like your hand's trying to go and touch the other person? Be careful, you might get slapped. It doesn't do that. So your body is fine, it's content, because your body is just rupa. Rupa is another word for Nibbana. Remember what I said earlier? Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankara, Vijnana, Nibbana. Arahatan Vahanse is Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankara and Vijnana. That is Nibbana. But Rupa Upadana, that's not Nibbana. Vedana Upadana, not Nibbana. Sanya Upadana, not Nibbana. Sankara Upadana, Vijnana Upadana, that's not Nibbana. Eradicate the upadana part, which is the clinging part, and now you're back to Nibbana. Therefore, your bodies have already attained Nibbana. What are you waiting for? Part of you is already in Nibbana. Which part? The physical part. What's lagging behind? The mind. Well done. Half of you have already attained Nibbana. Kudos. Well done, ladies and gentlemen. Your physical bodies have already attained Nibbana. That's why your body has no complaints. Your body has no complaints. When there's grey hair, does your hair complain about that? If a tooth falls, does it complain about that? No. Your body never complains. Because the body is content, it's always content, it has always been content. What's not content? The mind which thinks that I own this body is not content. That's bad news for them, isn't it? I know that's what you're thinking. See, of all weeks, today they decided to rain. We are prepared to create the conditions. I'm prepared to create the conditions. Dhanagarika Mahatayas are prepared to drive me there. I'm prepared to take my bowl and go begging. But they just don't have the merits. Therefore, an effect cannot manifest. See? Even you are prepared to create the conditions by giving the gift of giving. You suggested, let's do the first Sunday of every month. Right, so you were willing to make that sacrifice on their behalf. But look at what happened. Last Sunday, nice and shiny. Previous Sunday, lovely day. Sunday before, lovely day. And then today, it's as if it was planned. Wait, did you? That's the thing. That's why you need merits to do more merits. That's the way it works. It's a catch-22. I don't like that it is that way, but what can I do? You need merits to do more merits. See, those who have are those who have given. Because they have, they can do what more now? They can give more. And then they get more. And then they give more. And they get, and they get more. And they give more. See, those who have merits get an opportunity to do more merits. What about those who don't have? They're always complaining. Don't have. If I had, I would give. So they don't give. And because they don't give, they don't get. And because they don't get, they don't give. It's a vicious cycle. So there's no point in me stopping right now, then, is there? Of all Sundays. That's what I'm just thinking. Then how many people could have benefited from that? By offering their first offering maybe to the Mahasangha? I mean, they only have little to offer. So it's not like when you fill up the alms bowl and then you have to jump on it to like press everything back inside. It's not like they only have a little to offer. So because they only have a little to offer, we could have gone to many homes today. But hey-ho. They just don't have the merits. No merits to do merits. But talking about alms rounds, Pindapatha and so on, I have a little video to show you. So if you were at the monastery yesterday, you would have seen this. But I want to show this to you. As you know, a couple of our monks are currently in Australia. They're spreading the Dhamma, taking the gift of the Buddha far and wide, healing hearts and mending minds. That's what we do. So amidst the many programs that they're involved in, the retreats, the sermons, whenever they find the time, they also take their alms bowls and they go out on alms round. So that even locals can make their first offering to the Sambuddha Sasana. See, there's a difference between making a worldly offering and making an offering to something that is out of this world. When you make an offering to someone who is just a regular human being, that's good. But a regular human being does regular things, having taken what you have offered them. But if you offer something to someone who does something extraordinary, they step outside the ordinary, they use the energy that you give them to give an extraordinary gift to others. The investment that you make by making such an offering is immense. Because when it comes to merits, as much as demerits, folks, there are two parts that play here. Your contribution and the vipaka contribution. That's why If you have intention to give, the virtuousness of the receiving party has a part to play in the combined merit power that you acquire as a result of that giving. That is why in the Dakkhina Vibhanga Sutta, the Buddha explains how if you make an offering to an animal, it is meritorious, no question. But if you make the same offering to an unvirtuous human being, it far exceeds the merit power that you acquire to that you would have acquired by giving the same to an animal. These are not my words. These are the Buddha's. And then he says, if you make an offering to an unvirtuous human being, and then you make the same offering to a virtuous human being, this is not a noble one he speaks of, just someone who is virtuous. He's kind, he's gentle, he's soft-spoken, and so on. The merit power that you acquire out of that giving far exceeds the merit that you would have acquired by giving the same offering to an unvirtuous human being. And then he goes on to say, if you make the same offering to someone who is on the path to becoming a stream enterer, someone who is on the path to becoming a stream enterer, not someone who has still attained the fruit of stream entry, the merits that you acquire is 100,000-fold the merit power that you would have acquired by giving the same offering, grain for grain, the same offering, to someone who was merely a virtuous human being. See, on your part, no change, right? On your part, no change. That difference comes from the contribution that the Vipaka brings you. So he continues. He then talks about the stream enterer. He then talks about the one who's on the path to becoming a Sakrudagami, a seven-time returner. Then he talks about once on the path to once enterer, the anagami person. And then he talks about making an offering to an arahatun vahanse, or one who is on the path to becoming an arahant. And then he talks about the arahant. And then he talks about the paccheka buddha. And finally he says, if one makes an offering to a supreme buddha, the same offering, grain for grain, I repeat, the merit power that one acquires by making that same offering to an arahant, it is far exceeded by making that same offering, to a paccheka buddha, is far exceeded by the same offering that is made to a supreme buddha. And then he goes on to say, the same offering that is made to the buddha presiding the Mahasangha, not just the Buddha, but the Mahasangha, which includes the Buddha. If you recall, his stepmother on one occasion brings a finely woven robe to offer to the Buddha. You remember the story? And on this occasion, Venerable Ananda greets her and takes her to the Buddha. And he says, Venerable Sir, your stepmother is here to make an offering. Please, would you accept it? And the Buddha says, what? Ananda, I reject the offering. And Ananda, the Venerable Ananda, is shocked. So he goes back and says, I'm really sorry, but the Buddha has rejected your offering. But why does he do that? I'm his stepmother. I fed him when he was just a child. When his mother died 7 days after he was born, it was I who looked after him. Please, can you go remind him of that, Venerable Sir? So Venerable Ananda goes back to the Buddha and says, Sir, please be kind, please be accepting of this offering. And then the Buddha says, no, Ananda, I refuse that offering. And then he goes back again. And once again, when the Venerable Ananda comes back and makes a final plea, O most gracious one, you are the most compassionate one. Out of all the compassion that you have, would you please be so kind to accept the offering that your stepmother has brought you? She wants to make this offering privately and personally to you. And the Buddha says, Ananda, I know that it is my stepmother, and I know that a mother's love is beyond compare. I know that. And that is why I am refusing this offering. I want her to gain maximum merits by making this offering. Therefore, please advise her not to make this a personal offering to me, but make it an offering to the Mahasangha, which includes me as a component of that. He wanted to magnify the merits. He wanted to amplify the merits that Mahaprajapati Gotami could have acquired. That's why he said, let this not be a personal offering. On how many occasions have I by now told you not to make personal offerings, but only to make offerings to the Mahasangha? Because the reason for that, ladies and gentlemen, is this. On your side, the offering is the same, one to one. Grain for grain is the same offering. Robe for robe is the same offering. Kuti for kuti is the same offering. Cent for cent is the same offering. But if in your mind you make that offering to the Mahasangha, the virtues of the Mahasangha are infinite, but mine, not so. My virtues are very limited. In comparison to the Mahasangha, I'm like a drop in the vast ocean. So don't undermine your offering by making it a personal offering. Offer it always to the Mahasangha. And that way, you earn a lot more merits. Why do we need merits? Remember the path? That's why. That's why when you make an offering to a noble cause, then a noble cause will befall you. So what I want to show you now, in this video clip that you will see, is how our monks are rendering a tremendous service. And you think me coming here from Ingiri is a big deal. You should see those two monks and several other monks. Now, Guru Swami Mahansi these days is also away. He's taking the Dhamma to the Kenyans. I think by the time he gets back, he'll also have picked up Swahili a little bit. Knowing what he's like. He's a very good student, which is what makes him the best teacher. So he's going to be there for a few more weeks. And he said, well, on my way back, I'm going to bring a few Kenyans with me. I'm sure he will. I long for that day when among us will walk the first black man. Why am I so keen about that? Because here's what it'll do. It'll encourage more people. They'll understand this place is diverse. When actually we are not diverse. What is diversity? But it's all about the impression. Are we diverse? So at the monastery we have monks, we have anagarikas, and we have anagarikas. Really? We have adults and we have children. Really? We have a gentleman from Germany who's going to be a monk very soon. Really? We have no such thing. All we have are chittas aspiring to Nibbana. But when you look at it from the outside, it looks like there's a whole lot of diversity at the monastery. So people want to be part of that. And so they come. And once they come, we give them the gift. We give them the bullet. And then unbeknown to them, we inject them with the Dhamma. Before they know it, their zombie virus has been cured. And then they come back to their senses. And then they realize, gosh, I'm not a man after all. I'm not a woman after all. I'm not black after all. I'm not white after all. I'm no one after all. I'm just a chitta. But for that, initially, they have to be impressed enough to come along. Do you remember when you first visited the monastery, some of you had this concern, why were the pearl umbrellas, the mutukuda, not raised for the Anagarika Mahatmyas as they walked into the Dhamma hall? Some had that concern. It was held for the Swaminvahanses, it was accidentally held for the Anagarika Mahatmyas, and then when the Anagarika Mahatmyas arrived, the umbrellas were put away. So some had a question, why was that? Should they not be given equal treatment? Should who be given equal treatment? Women. Where are the women? Where are the ladies? But those are all conventions. So we always try to conform to conventions. Now sometimes when Anagarika Mahatmya, they go to preach the Dhamma, sometimes people wash their feet. So we have told them, no, don't do that. Don't do that. Because although some might do it out of reverence, out of respect, because it is the Dhamma that they bring. I mean, even if a donkey could deliver the Dhamma, we should wash its feet, I say. That's where I stand. It matters not what shape they come in, what size they come in, what figure they come in, right? It's the Dhamma that is arrived. But others will take a different view to that. Others, all sorts of others. And then, if we go against what society expects us to do, then we'll have to put practice in the Dhamma to a side and start debating with people and start arguing with people. What do you think I'd better do? Come and give you the Dhamma or go somewhere and argue with someone? That's why we just play as, when you're in Rome, do as the Romans do. When you're at Gateway College, when you're in Rajagiriya, do as the Rajagirians do. But when you're outside these four walls, you always conform to accepted norms. That is a must. Otherwise, you're just asking for trouble. But that's what ultimately, all there are achittas. There are no men, there are no women, there are no children, there are no adults. No such thing exists. These are just manifestations. Right. Without further ado, I'd like to show you the video now. What I want you all to do is to watch it and rejoice in it. These are your sons that you have offered to the sasana. These are your offerings. So the alms bowl that the venerable theros will be carrying with them might have been alms bowls that you had offered. The robes that they're wearing might have been robes that you have offered. The training that they have had, so that they are qualified to take the Dhamma to foreign lands, they would have had, having eaten the meals that you would have offered. So therefore, you all have had the part to play in making this a reality. Therefore, knowing that, acknowledging that, do rejoice in the great things that you have done together as a community. Can you all make that wish for them? That may be their first step. But why do we do it? So that those first steps lead to them taking their last steps. Last steps where? Last steps in samsara. They will not know today who they're making those offerings to. They won't know. Not until they listen to the Dhamma. But to listen to the Dhamma, they have to first make that offering. Because that creates the environment which then comes to them as a vipaka for them to listen to the Dhamma. That's why it always starts with giving. The whole path to Nibbana starts with giving. Because giving kicks off the receiving process. Giving is where it all starts. One day I'll explain to you how the vicious and the vileness that we see today in this world, in today's world, started with taking. Every wholesomeness in this world starts with giving. Every unwholesomeness in this world starts with taking, grasping, acquiring, hoarding. That's how it all starts. So Nibbana starts with giving. That's why whenever you give it in the name of Nibbana. Give it for the sake of Nibbana. Who's Nibbana? No. Nibbana. Because if you start thinking, who's Nibbana? Once again, you're taking something. Give. Just give. Not who's. For the cause. Not who's Nibbana. For the cause of Nibbana. Then what is rightfully yours will come your way. You need not worry about it. I didn't give for my Nibbana. I just gave. Right now, who do you think I'm giving for? My Nibbana. I'm just giving. What is rightfully mine will come. Do you remember a while back, I spoke to you about a little program that we have at the monastery called Little Britain? One day I'll show you a little documentary of how we do that at the monastery. But today I've brought with me a little specimen of that. They're inspired by what they see, what Mahindahamru does, what Bakulahamru does, taking the Dhamma far and wide, across the world, across the oceans, and how the Dhamma has transformed them, and therefore they want to do the same for others. Young children, they're inspired because that is the association they get. They get noble association. No wonder they're inspired by noble association. They don't get on a sofa and try to jump off it because it's not Superman that inspires them. They're inspired by the Mahasangha. So what they see day in, day out, they want to do. That's why when they were at home, they wanted to become engineers because you were one. They wanted to become doctors because you were one. But their parents knew better and therefore they gave their sons to the sasana. Now they look at what the fathers and the mothers in the sasana do. They look at what the Buddha did and now they want to do that, which is to heal as many people as they possibly can in their lifetime. I have brought along with me today a little specimen of that. It's not very little. One day I'll bring you a little one. But this young gentleman is only 15 years of age. I was so impressed by him because one day he walked up to me and in whatever little English he could put together, he said, "Nayakandru, are you also join Little Britain?" I asked him, "How much English do you know?" "Not know, but try." So I asked him, did you learn English at school? As a subject, he'd learned. He'd tried to go to an English medium school, but none were available where he lived. So he'd learned in the singular medium, but now looking at what his elder brothers are doing and his newfound parents are doing in the sasana, he wants to also become someone who can spread the Dhamma to many people far and wide. Because his target is 8 billion. Small heart, but a big ambition. So I want you to hear from him. I brought him along today because I wanted to give him a gift. The gift of Pindapatha. Maybe we'll try next week. Because the weather is not too kind today. But I want you to hear from him. He's still learning the language. But I want you to see what a young mind can do, what a young heart can do when it's rightly inspired, when the right ambitions are set in place, when associating the right kind of people and having the right attitudes, how far our young people are willing to go. He doesn't live for himself. Because he doesn't love to live. He lives to love. So, would you come up here, please?
May the Noble Triple Gem bless you all. My name is Ramji Chandiva. I'm 15 years old. When I came to monastery, I can't talk English. But I like to learn English. In my school also, I don't have English medium. But I very like to know English. And after I came to monastery, there are some English medium students in with me, my friends, and I tried to talk with them. And also, after few more days, my teacher knew I can learn English, and my teacher told to talk with others. I did it. After that, I can talk more than when I come to monastery. After I went to school, and our school principal put me into grade 10 English medium, and it's very helpful to my English studies. And after that, all our teachers and everyone knew about my English. And after, I think after 1 year, they started LB, Little Britain, and they put me into Little Britain. When I'm going to Little Britain, I can't talk English that much. Very more than grammar mistakes in this time, but I can talk than when I come to Little Britain. And I come to Little Britain, I knew something, because why I have to learn English? Because most of the people beings are suffering from something. Abhinagadeva was telling about what is the suffer, and most of them suffering. But I got the truth, and I know how to live from that. I practicing, but most of them don't know. Because of that, we have to tell to others. But Sinhala is common language in Sri Lanka. In other countries, don't know about that. But most of them know English language. Because of that, it's very helpful to spread Dhamma. And I think I have to learn English way more better than this. And I have to practice, because we have to salvage people. I think everyone can do this. All of people that know English, you can help others from this Dhamma and tell this Dhamma and leave everyone from this suffer. You can help. If you help, you can get help. That's why what you give, what you get. And you can do this. Every one of them can do this. That's why I came here. May the noble Tirun James.
Not so little after all, eh? These are the sons of the Buddha. See what great value the parents of this child have instilled within him. Today, he is someone who earns respect, and people are willing to worship at his feet. Soon enough, that will happen. Once he has completed his Anagarika program, we don't ordain them until they are 18. But even as an Anagarika, he observes the 10 precepts. You observe 6, he observes 10. He does his pratyaviksha before he takes his meals. He practices the Dhamma day in, day out. Wakes up at 4 o'clock in the morning. Practices till 10 in the evening. He lives among the Sangha. Therefore, he has become the Sangha. Did you hear why he wanted to learn the language? So that he could get into medical school. Yes? So that he could get himself a good job. Yes? Earn lots of money. Yeah? No. Those are things of the past. He doesn't undermine himself anymore like that. He realizes his human life is far more valuable than that. I wanted to give you a small sample of what you do for the sasana and where those contributions go. These are the great warriors in the making. When I leave this world one day, there should be 100 of me. No, 100 better than me. If I can do so much, 100 people who are better than me can do a lot more than that. That is why we live to love. Once you take out the love to live, then all there is the living to love. 15 years of age. 15. How old are you now? But he has the gift. He has the Dhamma. If you have a problem, he has the answer. You are 55, he's 15. He doesn't vex. He's not afraid. He doesn't want to watch TV. He can if he wants to. He doesn't want to. He doesn't find entertainment in listening to music. He enjoys giving goodness, giving wholesomeness to other people, healing hearts and mending minds. I just wanted to give you a sample of what your offerings have gone into making. Because every child at the monastery, we have to look after them. I can give them the Dhamma, but I can't give them the requisites. All that comes from your offerings. I just wanted to show you that they have all been meaningful. One of these days I'll bring you a small Bhatta. He's one of the Ayyas in the LB. You should see the Mallis as well. Each one as good as the next. Rejoice, ladies and gentlemen, rejoice. This is the Sri Sambuddha Sasana bearing fruit. And one day, we will change the world. We will help people. We will heal them. We will cure their mental suffering. We will take them out of their miserable lives. We will take them out of poverty by teaching them it is by giving that they receive. We will heal cancer by stopping people from becoming a cancer to society. We can do that. The Dhamma can heal. The Dhamma is panacea. It is the answer to all problems. So I want all of you to feel that as mothers and fathers, you have witnessed one of your sons. Because, truth be told, in this journey of samsara, you will have all been mothers and fathers to that child. You have all guided him in one way or the other to get to where he is today. Today, the Mahasangha look after him. But to bring him so far as to come close to us, every mother and every father in samsara played their part. I'll tell you more about Little Britain in future. Because right now it's in the oven. And it's cooking. Oh, wait till it comes out of the oven. Then it'll be a force to be reckoned with. We have a little agenda. Mara, beware. We are coming. Let's transfer the merits and bring the sermon to a close. Okay. First and foremost then, let us take a moment to transfer all the merits that we have acquired today. By listening to the Dhamma, inviting the Swami Nuhas to deliver the sermon, creating a conducive environment so that all could come along and practice peacefully and comfortably, let us first and foremost transfer these merits to the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, upasakas and upasikas, who have since time immemorial protected and preserved the sublime teachings of the Buddha and passed it down to the generations of the noble lineage in the form of the Tripitaka, which is thankfully available to us today to study, understand and comprehend the Dhamma. Let us take a moment to transfer these merits to all members of the Mahasangha present throughout the world, including the chief leaders of all of the chapters who have dedicated their lives to the noble path and have committed themselves to the betterment of all sentient beings, as well as the monks and nuns resident in your local temples and nunneries. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to Guru Swami Mahansi, our teacher, as well as all the monks resident at the monastery and the Anagarikas and Anagarikas attached to the monastery. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to those who make great efforts to disseminate the teachings of the Buddha, be that by transliterating these talks, sharing them out with others, or inviting others to join them. May they all rejoice in these merits. Let us also transfer these merits to our devotees and friends of the monastery, who for the sake of merits to help them attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana, continue to sustain the Mahasangha. This includes everyone from those of you who provide the Mahasangha with shelter, arms, robes and medicines, as well as those who pass on their know-how and continue to extend their well-wishes. May they all rejoice in these merits, and by the power of these merits, may they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to our mothers and fathers, brothers and sisters, sons and daughters, grandparents, uncles, aunts, cousins, nephews and nieces, our friends, our elders, our acquaintances, our employers and our employees, as well as our teachers and everyone who's helped us, supported us and assisted us in any way, shape or form. May they all rejoice in these merits, and by the power of these merits, may they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to the devas and brahmas, spirits and demons, primarily the Sakadeva, as well as all the numerous gods and deities who have protected and preserved the sublime teachings of the Buddha and passed it down. Let us also transfer these merits to our guardian deities who keep a watchful eye over us and keep us out of harm's way. May they prosper in divine power and wisdom. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to members of the armed forces, as well as the police force who sacrifice their lives to protect the peace and harmony of our nation. Let us remind ourselves that it is in the blood, sweat and tears that they have shed today, we are able to practice the path in peace and harmony. Let us also transfer these merits to those who lost their lives in the war, be they friend or foe, as well as those who lost their lives in natural disasters and calamities such as the tsunamis and earthquakes, landslides, fires, floods, pandemics and so on. Reminding ourselves that in this infinitely long journey of samsara, they will all have been mothers and fathers to us, brothers and sisters to us, friends to us. They will have helped us, supported us and assisted us in any way, shape or form possible and available to them. And therefore, with a sense of gratitude towards all that they have done for us and a boundless sense of compassion and loving kindness, let us transfer all the merits we have acquired to all of them. May, by the power of these merits, if any of them have been born in the woeful planes, they redeem themselves and be born in the blissful plane. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And finally, may by the power and blessings of all the merits we have acquired throughout the day, we be able to witness the advent of many hundreds of thousands of arahants on this blessed land. And finally, may you and I, and everyone who's helped make this program a success, become a Rahatan Vahanse or an Arahataranin Vahanse in this very life itself and in the era of the Gautama Supreme Buddha itself. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. May the blessings of the Noble Triple Gem be with you all. The members of the Mahasangha will now transfer their blessings to you. Raga ginnan midatnva, dvesha ginnan midatnva, moha ginnan midatnva, nibbana parama sukhayan, sukhita taravetnva, nibbana parama sukhayan, sukhita taravetnva, mamada siyalu loka, siyalu satnvayo, nibbana parama sukhayan, sukhita taravetnva, nibbana parama sukhayan, sukhita taravetnva, nibbana parama sukhayan, sukhita taravetnva.
raga gini neva, dvesha gini neva, moha gini neva, nivansapa labeva. Nivan sapa labeva. Nivan sapa labeva. Tunduvange suvisi ananta maha guna belen, siilu loka siilu satteoma, nibbana paramasukhen suvita taravetva. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.